are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. Broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia.
You're listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional engineer, professional futurist, and sometimes occasional sessional instructor of future studies at Simon Fraser University. And this is a weekly show that looks at future trends and issues and important items that affect your daily life and will be affecting your life into the future. Welcome to the show. We're continuing our look at the book, The Biology of Belief, Unleashing the Power of Consciousness, Matter, and Miracles by Bruce H. Lipton, PhD. In the last show, we were looking at the section, chapter, It's the Environment, Stupid. Watson and Crick explained why DNA is the perfect hereditary molecule. Each DNA strand is normally intertwined with a second strand of DNA, a loosely wrapped configuration known as the double helix. The genius of this system is that the sequences of DNA bases on both strands are actually mirror images of each other. When the two strands unwind, each single strand contains the information to make an exact, complementary copy of itself. So through a process of separating the strands of a double DNA helix, DNA molecules become actually self-replicating. This observation led to the assumption that DNA controlled its own replication. It was its own boss. The suggestion that DNA controlled its own replication and served as the blueprint for the body's proteins led Francis Crick to create biology's central dogma, the belief that DNA rules. This dogma is so fundamental to modern biology, it is essentially written in stone, the equivalent of science's Ten Commandments. The dogma, also referred to as the primacy of DNA, is a fixture of every scientific text. In the dogma's scheme of how life unfolds, DNA perches loftily on top, followed by RNA. RNA is the short-lived Xerox copy of the DNA. As such, it is the physical template encoding the amino acid sequence that makes up a protein's backbone. The primacy of DNA diagrams provides the logic for the age of genetic determinism. Because the character of a living organism is defined by the nature of its proteins, and its proteins are encoded by its DNA, then it follows by logic that DNA would represent the first cause, or primary determinant, of an organism's traits. The Human Genome Project. After DNA achieved its superstar status, the remaining challenge was to create a catalog of all the genetic stars in the human filament. Enter the Human Genome Project, a global scientific effort begun in the late 1980s to create a catalog of all the genes present in humans. From the onset, the Human Genome Project was a massively ambitious one. Conventional thought held that the body needed one gene to provide the blueprint for each of the 100,000 plus different proteins that make up our bodies. Add to that at least 20,000 regulatory genes, which orchestrate the activity of the protein encoding genes. Scientists concluded that the human genome would contain a minimum of 120,000 genes located within the 23 pairs of human chromosomes. But that actually wasn't the whole story. A cosmic joke was unfolding, one of those jokes that periodically unsettle scientists convinced that they have discovered the secrets of the universe. Consider the impact of Nicholas Copernicus's discovery, published in 1543, that the Earth was not the center of the universe, as was thought by the scientists, theologians of the day. The fact that the Earth actually revolves around the Sun, and the Sun itself is not the center of the universe, undermined the sacred teachings of the Catholic Church. Copernicus's paradigm-busting discoveries launched the modern scientific revolution by challenging the presumed infallibility of the Church. Science eventually displaced the Church as Western civilization's source of wisdom for understanding the mysteries of the universe. Geneticists experienced a comparable shock when, contrary to their expectations of over 120,000 genes, they found that the entire human genome consists of only approximately 25,000 genes. More than 80% of the presumed and required DNA simply does not exist. The missing genes are proving to be more troublesome than the missing 18 minutes of the Nixon tapes. The one gene, one protein concept was a fundamental tenet of genetic determinism. Now that the Human Genome Project has toppled the one gene for one protein concept, our current theories of how life works have to be scrapped. No longer is it possible to believe that genetic engineers can, with relative ease, fix all of our biological dilemmas. There are simply not enough genes to account for all the complexity of human life or of human disease. I may sound a little bit like Chicken Little shouting that the genetics sky is falling. However, you don't have to take my word for it. Chicken Big is saying the same thing. In a complimentary on the surprising results of the Human Genome Project, David Baltimore, one of the world's preeminent geneticists and a Nobel Prize winner, addressed the issue of human complexity. Quote, "But unless the human genome contains a lot of genes that are opaque to our computers, it is clear that we do not gain our undoubted complexity over worms and plants by simply using more and more genes. Understanding what does give us our complexity, our enormous behavioral repertoire, ability to produce conscious action, remarkable physical coordination, precisely tuned alterations in response to external variations in the environments, learning, memory, need I go on, remains a serious challenge for future generations of scientists. As Baltimore states, the results of the Human Genome Project force us to consider other ideas about how life is controlled. Understanding what does give us our complexity remains a challenge for the future. The sky is falling. In addition, the results of the Human Genome Project are forcing us to reconsider our genetic relationship with other organisms in the biosphere. We can no longer use genes to explain why humans are at the top of the evolutionary ladder. It turns out there is not much difference in the total number of genes found in humans as those found in relatively primitive organisms. Let's take a closer look at three of the most studied animal models in genetic research. A microscopic nematode roundworm known as K. norhabilitis elegans, the fruit fly, and the laboratory mouse. The primitive K. norhabditis worm serves as a perfect model for studying the role of genes in development and behavior. This rapidly growing and reproducing organisms has a precise pattern body comprised of exactly 969 cells and a simple brain of about 302 cells. Nevertheless, it has a unique repertoire of behaviors, and most importantly, it is amenable to genetic experimentation. The A. norhabditis genome consists of approximately 24,000 genes. The human body, comprised of over 50 trillion cells, contains only 1,500 more genes than the lowly, spineless, thousand-celled microscopic worm. The fruit fly, another favored research subject, has 15,000 genes. So the profoundly more complicated fruit fly has 9,000 fewer genes than the more primitive K. norhabditis worm. And when it comes to the question of mice and men, we might have to think more highly of them or less of ourselves. The results of parallel genome projects reveals that humans and rodents have roughly the same number of genes. Fancy that. Cell Biology 101. In retrospect, scientists should have known that genes couldn't provide the control of our lives. By definition, the brain is the organ responsible for controlling and coordinating the physiology and behavior of an organism. But is the nucleus truly the cell's brain? If our assumption is that the nucleus and its DNA contain material is the brain of the cell, then removing the cell's nucleus, a procedure called enucleation, would result in immediate death of the cell. And now for the big experiment. The scientist drags our unwilling cell into the microscope operating arena and straps it down. Using a micromanipulator, the scientist guides a needle-like micropipette into position above the cell. With a deft thrust of the manipulator, our investigator plunges the pipette deep into the cell's cytoplasmic interior. By applying a little suction, the nucleus is drawn up into the pipette, and the pipette is withdrawn from the cell. Below the nucleus-engorged pipette lies our sacrificial cell. Its brain has been torn out. But wait. Amazingly, it is still moving. My God, even without its brain, the cell is still alive. The wound has closed, and like a recovering surgical patient, the cell begins to slowly stagger about. Soon the cell is back on its feet, fleeing the microscope's field with the hope that it will never see a doctor again. Following this rather aggressive process of enucleation, many cells can survive for up to 2 or more months without genes. Viable enucleated cells do not lie about like brain-dead lumps of cytoplasm or life support systems. These cells actively ingest and metabolize food, maintain coordinate operation of the physiological systems like respiration, digestion, excretion, mobility, retain an ability to communicate with other cells, and are able to engage in appropriate responses to growth and protection requiring environmental stimuli. Unsurprisingly, enucleation is not without side effects. Without their genes, cells are not able to divide, nor are they able to reproduce any protein parts they lose through the normal wear and tear of the cytoplasm. Their inability to replace defective cytoplasmic proteins contributes to mechanical dysfunctions that will ultimately, as expected, result in the death of the cell. Our experiment was designed to test the idea that the nucleus is the brain of the cell. If the cell had died immediately following enucleation, the observations would have at least supported that belief. However, the results are unambiguous. Enucleated cells still exhibit complex, coordinated, life-sustaining behaviors, which imply that the cell's brain is still intact and functioning. The fact that enucleated cells retain their biological functions in the absence of genes is by no means a new discovery. Over 100 years ago, classical embryologists routinely removed the nuclei from dividing egg cells and showed that a single enucleated egg cell was able to develop as far as the blastula, an embryonic stage consisting of 40 or more cells. Today, enucleated cells are used for industrial purposes as living feeder layers in cell cultures designed for virus vaccine production. If the nucleus and its genes are not the cell's brain, then what exactly is DNA's contribution to cellular life? Enucleated cells die, not because they have lost their brain, but because they have lost their reproductive capabilities. Without the ability to reproduce their parts, enucleated cells cannot replace failed protein building blocks, nor replicate themselves. So the nucleus is not the brain of the cell. The nucleus is the cell's gonad. Confusing the gonad with the brain is an understanding error, because science has always been, and still is, a patriarchal endeavor. Males have often been accused of thinking with their gonads, so it's not entirely surprising that science has inadvertently confused the nucleus with the cell's brain.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 cable FM in Burnaby, and you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, Instructor of Future Studies at Simon Fraser University. We're now going to take a short break and listen to a very important public service announcement.
With thousands of homeless animals entering SPCA shelters each year, pet overpopulation is a serious problem in BC. But it's one you can help prevent. Spay or neuter your companion animal today. From our perspective, every homeless animal on our streets or in our shelters is one too many. For more information on spaying and neutering initiatives, visit the BC SPCA website at www.spca.bc.ca.
Welcome back. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional futurist.
Welcome back. We are looking at the book, The Biology of Belief, Unleashing the Power of Consciousness, Matter, and Miracles by Bruce H. Lipton, PhD. We are looking at the section, Is the Environment Stupid? The chapter, Epigenetics, the New Science of Self-Empowerment. Genes, as destiny theorists, have obviously ignored 100-year-old science about enucleated cells, but they cannot ignore new research that undermines their belief in genetic determinism. While the Human Genome Project is making headlines, a group of scientists were inaugurating a new revolutionary field in biology called epigenetics. The science of epigenetics, which literally means control above genetics, profoundly changes our understanding of how life is controlled. In the last decade, epigenetic research has established that DNA blueprints passed down through genes are not set in concrete at birth. In other words, genes are not destiny. Environmental influences, including nutrition, stress, and emotions, can modify these genes without changing their basic blueprint. And these modifications, epigeneticists have discovered, can be passed on to future generations as surely as DNA blueprints are passed on via the double helix. There is no doubt that epigenetic discoveries have lagged behind genetic discoveries. Since the late 1940s, biologists have been isolating DNA from the cell's nucleus in order to study genetic mechanisms. In the process, they extract the nucleus from the cell, break open its enveloping membrane, and remove the chromosomal contents, half of which is made up of DNA and half of which is made up of regulatory proteins. In their enthusiasm to study DNA, most scientists threw away the proteins, which we now know is the equivalent of throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Epigeneticists are bringing back the baby by studying the chromosome's proteins, and these proteins are turning out to play a crucial role in hereditary DNA. In the chromosome, the DNA forms the core, and the proteins cover the DNA like a sleeve. When the genes are covered, their information cannot be read. Imagine your bare arm as a piece of DNA representing the gene that codes for blue eyes. In the nucleus, this stretch of DNA is covered in and bound regulatory proteins, which cover your blue eye gene like a shirt sleeve, making it impossible to be read. How do you get that sleeve off? You need an environmental signal to spur the sleeve protein to change shape. In other words, detach from the DNA's double helix, giving it the gene to be read. Once the DNA is uncovered, the cell makes a copy of the exposed gene. As a result, the activity of the gene is controlled by the presence or absence of ensleeving proteins, which are in turn controlled by environmental signals. The story of epigenetic control is the story of how environmental signals control the activity of the genes. It is now clear that the primacy of the DNA chart described earlier is outmoded. The revised scheme of information flow should now be called the primacy of the environment. The new, more sophisticated flow of information in biology starts with an environmental signal, then goes to a regulatory protein, and only then goes to DNA, RNA, and the end of the result protein. The science of epigenetics has also made it clear that there are two mechanisms by which organisms can pass on hereditary information. These two mechanisms provide a way for scientists to study both the contribution of nature in the form of genes and the contribution of nurture, epigenetic mechanisms, in human behavior. If you only focus on the blueprints, as scientists have been doing for decades, the influence of the environment is impossible to fathom. Let's present an analogy which hopefully will make the relationship between epigenetics and genetic mechanisms more clear. Are any of you old enough to remember the days when television programming stopped after midnight? After the normal programming signed off, a test pattern would appear on the screen. Most test patterns look like a dartboard with a bullseye in the middle. Think of the pattern of the test screen as the pattern encoded by a given gene, say one for brown eyes. The dials and switches of the TV fine-tune the test screen by allowing it to turn it on and off and modulate the number of characteristics, including color, hue, contrast, brightness, vertical and horizontal holds. By adjusting the dials, You could alter the appearance of the pattern on the screen while not actually changing the original broadcast pattern. This is precisely the role of regulatory proteins. Studies of protein synthesis reveal that epigenetic dials can create 2,000 or more variations of proteins from the same genetic blueprint. Parental life experiences shape their children's genetic character. We now know that the environmentally influenced fine-tuning described above can be passed from generation to generation. A landmark Duke University study in August 2003, issue of Molecular and Cellular Biology, found that an enriched environment can often override genetic mutations in mice. In this study, scientists looked at the effect of dietary supplements on pregnant mice with an abnormal gene. This abnormal gene in mice produces yellow coats and are extremely obese, which predisposes them to cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and cancer. In the experiment, one group of yellow obese mothers received methyl group-rich supplements available in health food stores, which included folic acid, vitamin B12, betaine, and choline. Methyl-rich supplements were also chosen because a number of studies have shown that the methyl chemical group involved with epigenetic modifications. When methyl groups attach to the gene's DNA, it changes the binding characteristics of regulatory chromosomal pattern proteins. If the proteins bind too tightly to the gene, the protein sleeve cannot be removed and the gene cannot be read. Methylating DNA can silence or modify gene activity. This time, the headlines, "Diet Trumps Genes," are accurate. The mothers who got the methyl-rich supplements produced standard lean brown mice, even though their offspring had the same gene as their mothers. The mothers who didn't get supplements produced yellow pups, which ate much more than the brown pups. The yellow pups wound up weighing almost twice as much as their lean, pseudo-mutated gene counterparts. Photos of these mice are striking. Though the two mice are genetically identical, they are radically different in appearance. One mouse is lean and brown, the other mouse is obese and yellow. What you can't see in the pictures is that the obese mice is diabetic because its genetically identical counterpart is healthy. So in the future, we're going to be looking, on future shows, we're going to be looking at the impacts of epigenetics and how it's modifying our whole view of the human genome and how it acts to make us human. So please stay tuned to future shows.
You have been listening to Future Talk on CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 cable FM in Burnaby. And Future Talk is a weekly show on important issues that affect you and your future. And this is Dr. Teneri, professional futurist, reminding you that if you're not willing to make the effort to invent your own future, then others will be only too happy to invent it for you. See you next week.
Listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
So, sun rahe ho CJSF 90.1 FM, jo ki Burnaby, British Columbia, which sthit hai.